It's a pleasure to be here. And I've been exploring the city today. I've been exploring Belgium. I haven't had a waffle yet. Believe it or not, I've actually not had a waffle yet. But maybe we'll have some later on. Today we're going to be talking about a topic which is very important to many people, especially here in Western Europe, which is the issue of feminism. Now, obviously, we're going to bring in the Islamic perspective. But before I do so, what I wanted to do was be very straightforward with you and outline the main crux, the main thrust of my argument. My argument is simple. It is that feminism, especially second wave understandings of feminism, have failed in being able to provide for women well-being. In other words, and in fact, this is a secondary proposition, I will say that feministic prescriptions or recommendations, this is my postulation here, have put women in a position of deteriorated well-being. This is what I'm saying. So the question is, first of all, what is feminism? Obviously, someone will say, well, to look and see what feminism is, it is equality politically, socially, and economically. Almost everyone agrees that there should be equality at a general level. I don't think anyone disagrees with this point. But if you really want to know what feminism is, especially when we talk about second wave conceptions, one must refer back to the 1960s, to the movement, to the literature, to the writings. For example, one must read Betty Friedan, who wrote The Feminine Mystique, 1963. And she famously said that a woman in a house is living in a comfortable concentration camp. One must read Simone de Beauvoir, which I'm sure many of you will be able to access in French even, but who has written The Second Sex, a very important book, and see what kind of arguments that she was making, where she made arguments explicitly, made arguments against conceptions, traditionalist conceptions of the family, of motherhood, etc. One must go back to Germaine Greer, who once again lived at that time and wrote The Female Eunuch. One must go back to these people, and if one does do that, one will realize that there was a very intentional attack on the institution of the family. Now, you will say this is not substantiated. I will say something to you which maybe many of you didn't know. Betty Friedan, who wrote The Feminine Mystique in 1963, some 58 years ago, Betty Friedan herself wrote a book called The Second Sage. She wrote this book in 1981. And in this book, she openly admits, she says, we must look within, relating to how we have actually reduced conceptions of the family. And when commenting on her famous line that the house is a comfortable concentration camp, she refers to her own statement 20 years later as an extreme statement. So by the admission of the authors themselves, there has been a failure. One must also think of something else. Betty Friedan, who wrote this book, who told women that they must prioritize their careers first. This is what they must do. She actually ran some surveys. She was known for doing surveys and doing studies. And to her dismay, she found in the 1970s, she found that women, after the legislative or law changes that took place in America, and by the way, in all of Western Europe as well, that they were suffering more, not less, And that was actually her conclusion. That was her conclusion. And then she says herself, this is Betty Friedan, not Muhammad Hijab. It's not the Muslim fundamentalist, the hate preacher, the extremist, whoever, this one, that one. No, it is Betty Friedan herself. She states that one third of women that she surveyed, they suffered from mental breakdown. And this was way more than the surveys that she ran in the 1950s and 60s. So according to her, things were getting worse, not better. According to the feminist, the founding mother of feminism, second wave feminism, things are getting worse, not better. Okay, one will still be skeptical and say, this is maybe not enough of an evidence for me. Jermaine Greer, who wrote a book called The Female Eunuch. A eunuch is somebody, is a man who has his private part castrated. Okay. She wrote this book. She was it's satirical. She was trying to make fun of a situation, talking about the woman, basically. And she, in 1981 or 1983, I forget exactly when, she wrote a book called The Whole Woman. And she said something very interesting that I will never forget. Because she was advising women not to have children. That's how bad it was. She was saying, women, don't have children. That's what she said. And the reason why she said that is because, just like Simone de Beauvoir in her book, The Second Sex, if you read the chapter on biology, she believed that it's an oppressive relationship. The moment you become a mother, you're oppressed. You're oppressed by virtue of being a mother. She made this very clear. Jermaine Greer, in her book, The Whole Woman, she said, and I quote, this is word for word, she goes, I mourn for my unborn children. Now, what does this mean? When you mourn, you go to the graveyard, you're crying, yeah? All of these things. Now, how can you mourn for your unborn children? She says, I mourn for my unborn children, meaning what? That she regrets not having children. Can you imagine a woman who convinced tens of millions of women not to have children, not to prioritize motherhood, not to engage in career activity, instead and as a substitute to being a mother and a housewife, call it what you want to call it. She herself, 20 years later, that same woman, she says, I regret the situation. I mourn. This is strong language. I mourn for my unborn children. I wish I had children. This is unfair that you convince tens of millions of women. Yes, you convince tens of millions of women that motherhood is not important, that having a career is. And then she says, I mourn for my unborn children. Now, the same woman, Jermaine Greer, she says, now we have to look. Can you imagine she says this? All I'm telling you to do is look at the confessions of the feminists. Forget about me, what I say. Look at the confessions of the feminists. She says, now we have to look at motherhood being a full-time career option. This is exactly what she states. Jermaine Greer herself. Simone de Beauvoir, who most of you, maybe you'll know her name a little bit because, you know, she had a boyfriend called Sartre. You know, Jean-Paul Sartre. You may know this guy. Existentialist, you know, and he's French speaking and stuff. So you know who he is, maybe. Put your hands up if you've heard any of these names before. Okay, we're all on the same page. Maybe not one of them. Anyways, this is what she says. Listen to this, yeah? She is very categorical. Simone de Beauvoir, she's seen as one of the top feminists in the 60s, yeah? I was reading her autobiography because I was interested to see what the kind of woman this is. I was very, very shocked and surprised. I was dismayed, disillusioned. She had an apartment. I think it was either in Paris or New York. I forget where the apartment was. And she was in love with this Sartre. Yeah? She was in love with him. He is, by the way, he is the one who told her to write a book on feminism. She writes this in her autobiography. He gave me the idea. And then she says, when he was coming back, from wherever he was, going traveling, and now he's coming back. She says, I was cleaning the house. That's the first red flag. I thought, wait a minute here. Am I reading this is from the right pages? Wait a minute, cleaning the house? She goes, yes, I was cleaning the house. I was getting everything ready for him. It's the same woman that's telling you, don't be a mother. That, you know, don't you dare do domestic activities. And then I went further and reading. Do you know what she states? Simone de Beauvoir. She goes, because Sartre is my true superior. I said, this is the mother of feminism saying this. I said, my wife never said anything like that. We're meant to be the traditionalists here. I even showed it to my wife. I said, look what she said. She said, that's her. That's a different story, you know. Even she thought it was too extreme. I mean, what is this? She goes, true superior. So I was wondering, why is it that these founding mothers of feminism, they have one speech to the public, to other women, and another speech in their private life? And I think they know, and we know now that they do, that their theories are false. Now, one of the biggest studies I think this is the biggest study that I've ever seen on the well-being of women. It is called Blanche Flower and Oswald. Blanche Flower and Oswald, these are two names of the people, yeah? And it's a longitudinal study from the years 1970 to 1990. It is the longest study that was conducted on 100,000 women. Are there some feminists out there chanting? They know what I'm about to say. That's why they're doing that. I'm about to drop facts. I'm about to drop bombs. No, I don't mean those kinds of bombs. I know the SS are here, the secret services. But let me repeat this point because it's imperative. It's very important. The biggest study that has ever been done to my knowledge, was it conducted by some anti-feminists or did this person? No, it was conducted by people who were neutral to this whole situation. They wanted to find out. The question they wanted to know was, are feministic policies now that have now been enacted, are they making women's lives easier or are they making their lives harder? This is the question. They want to find out. Is the career path a path that's making people's women's lives, is it making it easier or is it making it harder? They had a sample of 100,000 women. That's huge. 20 years from 1970 to 1990. And the conclusion was that the well-being of women has deteriorated. This is an incredible conclusion. It is the biggest study that has ever been done on this point. And it has shown that feministic policies, that women going into the workplace, all of this stuff, and doing exactly what a man is doing, is actually affecting their lives in the negative. Now, I thought all the feministic confessions, that's one thing. Maybe this study is a coincidence as well. So I started looking deeper into the issue, and I found that this was something almost every study that I've seen on the issue has said the same thing about. For example, there is a study by the Policy Studies Institute that has come to the same conclusion, that well-being for women has deteriorated in the last 60 years. There was even a magazine called Top Sartre Magazine, which polled women's health. 78% of recipients, women, They said if they could, they would quit their job tomorrow. Imagine having a workforce, 80% almost of the workforce of women, they want to leave. They don't like it. It's a prison for them. Isn't this an irony? Because this is exactly what Betty Friedan said. You need to leave your comfortable concentration camp, your prison. The home is the prison. But now women are saying en masse in the West that actually what's the prison is the work. 78% of recipients, women, all women, said if they could, they would quit their jobs tomorrow. 80% of the same magazine, they said that their job has led to psychological breakdown, nervous breakdown, has led to deteriorated mental conditions. 80%. 80. Now, I want you to ask you a question. If we got the same, and I don't think the study has been done, if we got a study of women, all of which have been mothers, and they were full-time mothers in the home with the children, do you think, honestly, that 80% would want to stop being mothers? Honestly, do you think this? Do you think 80% would want to quit being mothers? No chance. No chance. So feminists, unfortunately, have sold us all a lie. When I say us, the ones who have suffered the most have not been men. Wallahi, I believe, and wallahi means for the non-Muslims here, by God, I believe the ones who have benefited the most from feminists are men. I believe that. Why? Let me tell you why. Because I, as a man, don't have to commit. I don't have to commit to a woman. I can go from one woman to another woman with no responsibility whatsoever. I don't have to provide for her any protection. These are roles. My resources don't have to be extracted anymore. I don't have to provide for children. I don't have to do any of these things if I live a feministic lifestyle. If I wasn't a religious man, I'd try my best to find a feminist. If I wasn't a Muslim man, I'd say, listen, I want a feminist. I want a strong, independent. Why? Because if I'm walking with the feminist in the street and she's 5'2" and I'm 6'6", 120 kilos, and she's 50 kilo, and a burglar comes or a robber, hey, come on, take your stuff. I say, come on, 50. What are you going to do? What do you want? Or if, for example, I was sitting in the restaurant eating what's the other food that you eat with the oysters? This, I tried it today, wasn't it? Yeah. No, and the Belgians, they talk about immigration. You should be thankful that you have people coming from Morocco to give you tagine. Especially if she's a Belgian woman, and I don't want to generalize, but they have a very stern attitude, these some Belgian people. I'm making a joke, Yanni, don't take it too personally. But this morning I was in the hotel and I was looking around and everyone was silent. What's going on here? Have I said something? Have I done something? And then I started walking away, yeah? Because I thought, these people are doing this because of me. And I looked back to see if these people are operating in this manner. And I saw that this is the Belgian culture, that you're very quiet, they're very, you know, you need some flavor in your life, man. I looked back and I saw they were all being the same way. And I thought, it must not be me. This is actually how they are. I thought they were scared of me, honestly. And I was going into the elevator and I saw a woman. Usually I'm the one who lowers my gaze. The moment she saw me, she went. I was like, this woman here, she beat me to it. I say, what kind of Islam is she following? She's following the strict type. She must be an ultra conservative Salafist, but she's wearing tight jeans for some reason. Anyway, if I wasn't a religious man, I would go for a feminist because I have the least responsibilities. Wallahi, I would. If I wasn't a religious man, if I wasn't a Muslim, I would say, please, where's the feminist? So I would pretend to be a feminist, maybe. You would as well. Don't worry, you don't have to. You don't have the physical stature that would make anyone scared. No, I'm only joking. I would say yes. But what I'm saying is, feminism has not benefited women as much as it has benefited. I think it's benefited men. I think it really has. Now, a woman going into the workplace having a double burden, wanting to leave because she has mental disorders, cycle, and 80% of the workforce are like that. Tell me how that benefits women. I want to know how. And then, in addition to all of this, now you're burdened with the work and you go home and you have this responsibility and that responsibility and stress and all of these things. And you have to be competitive and then you have to be feminine and then you have to, and all these expectations that are just overburdening you as a woman. And now, still, you want to inflict this pain upon yourself. After 60 years, we've seen it's affected millions of women in the negative with their own self-admission. The feminists themselves have retracted their positions, many of them. And we still want to play with fire. It's not helping us. And this is something else I want to say. Feminism has not only hurt women and deteriorated their well-being, as we have seen by their own admission, but feminism has also hurt children. And I'm not talking about abortion, although we could talk about that, because as Muslims, we have more flexibility than Catholics. I don't have a strong stance of, you know, contraception, this and that, but there are points, some feminists have made some arguments, not all feminists, to be fair, that over like 5-6 months there should be abortion still allowed. 6 months. Have you seen a six-month-old baby? What it looks like. It's a fully formed baby. You can actually put it into an incubator and it will live. Now, I'm not taking a strong stance. Actually, I believe that within 40 days, you can have an abortion. That's the Hanbali madhab. Some say 3 months if there's an excuse. So Islam is not as cutthroat as Catholicism. However, yes, 4 months. Sorry, I do apologize. 4 months. It's 120 days. 3, 6, 9, 12, yeah, just to make sure. Yes, that is pretty. However, when they start making arguments for 5 or 6 months and say pro-life, now scientifically the baby can live by itself. It's viable. It has a heart, has a brain. I think that's where we're crossing the line here. However, putting that to the side, why do I say feminism or feministic prescriptions and recommendations have harmed children? Because when we look at the data, the demographic data of children that are the least advantaged, we find that it's children, unfortunately, in households which are single parent. And I'm going to be very controversial here. Almost all the studies that have been done on the issue have shown that homosexual man or man, female or female, partnerships have yielded negative results for children. For example, delinquency. There's an increased, almost every single study, every single one, almost, has shown there's an increased level of delinquency, a reduced level of education, more chance that that child will come out with pathology, psychological pathology. All of that when there's two partners of the same gender or the same sex. And I had a conversation with one particular professor who specializes in, and this is online, in fact. I was very surprised by this conversation, and also it's in his books and works, peer-reviewed works. His name is Nicholas Wolfinger. And I had a conversation, I asked him, so then if we identify that that's the case demographically, yes, if those kinds of family structures are the most problematic, then which ones are the most advantageous? This is what he said. He said, nuclear families. Now, the guy himself is left-wing guy. If you see what he's not a religious neoconservative guy and nothing like that. He said, we have to be honest with the data. He said, look, when we look at the data, we find that nuclear families, where there is traditional gender roles, and he says something very interesting, and where there is religion practiced in that house. He said, it doesn't matter what religion. I'm being honest with what he said. I could say Islam or this. No, I'm not. I'm saying this is what he said. When there is regular religion practiced in that house, the children are more likely to succeed educationally and they're less likely to be criminals, basically, in the future. That's what he said. That's his data. It's been peer-reviewed. Now, he does it in the American context. Now, we can do that in other contexts and see if it's in Belgium like that or not. But the point is, when you have a nuclear-type family, the traditional roles, this has shown to be most advantageous for children. So there's two things I started off by saying. In this discussion, I started off by saying what? I started off by saying, number one, that I can demonstrate through studies and evidence and admission that feminism or feministic recommendations have harmed women. And now we have the founding mothers of feminism saying the same, retracting their statements and saying, yes, we have to look at this again. And do you know what Betsy Friedan even said? I was so shocked when I read this. She said that we had to revise our decisions. But when I go back to feminists to tell them about this, I'm paraphrasing here, but this particular phrase is what she said. She goes, there's almost a religious feeling about it now. It's out of my hands. So she's created the Frankenstein, and now she cannot stop the Frankenstein. She goes, now I'm going back, and yes, the data shows all these things that I've talked about. I'm trying to stop them. I'm trying to reason with them. I'm trying to tell them this is wrong. But now feminism has become like there's a religious feeling around it. There's a religious feeling about it. That's what she's saying. And this is one of the women who many historians say second wave feminism started, her book started in 1963. Second wave feminism started then. Many historians say that. So can you imagine that same woman, she's saying, now I'm trying to go back and tell this woman, and there's a religious feeling about it. Therefore, and I say this with all clarity, yes, it can be deduced, it can be concluded that the 60-year experiment of feminism has shown us that this idea of putting careers before families, especially before motherhood, this idea of domestic drudgery, Rolodia called it, a woman, for example, thinking that she has to take care of her child. She's a woman, she refutes feminism after being one herself in her book in 1998. She says that they have reduced looking after children like mopping the floor. Yani for them, many of these feminists, she's attacking, she's saying this. She says, raising a child for these feminists is akin to household chores like mopping the floor. These same women are the ones who are saying, we regret, we mourn for our unborn children. Now we have to look at the motherhood as a proper, you know, thing. So why do we need to, you know, if you've seen somebody, it takes a clever person to learn from their mistakes. You're not a fool. If you put your hands on fire and it hurts, you know, you put your hand away. It takes a wise person to learn from someone else's mistakes. Now you look back in history, 60 years, this has not succeeded. Women are saying, en masse, we are dissatisfied with this option of life. It's caused us mental disorder, pathology, breakdown. We're dissatisfied. We're unhappy. That's what they're saying. Those who have tried it. Now, this is the young generation. You have two options. Either you can decide for the women here and for the men. Men can decide to take responsibility. Be the responsible ones. And we're going to come to the Islamic thing after the break, because there's going to be Maghrib in a second, so we want to have a break. But we can decide, as we said, to take responsibility. We can decide to learn from the mistakes of those who came before us. We can decide not to play around with a already failed experiment. If we all saw a plane taking off and then it crashes, okay, well, let's go to the next one. No, no. No thanks. We don't need to try that again. And many women know already how this feels. Many of you will have gone to work and tried that life, and you forget how it made you feel. Or that you've never tried with motherhood, and you think that this is better than this. Or that, and I don't think I'm going to find a woman that says, I'd rather be a career woman than a mother. I've never yet met her. You know, the woman that says, if she's a mother, she says, I'm going to leave my career. Because the thing is, your child can't say to you, you're fired. You know, you've done your job now. You've done your thing. And the thing is, it's so ironic, isn't it? That a lot of career orientation means that when you go to work, there's going to be a man there telling you what to do. So it's the same kind of thing as a hierarchy, his policies and all this kind of thing. Maybe in this very university, which is meant to be pluralistic, maybe the head of it is a man. I don't know. Maybe two men, three men. Or maybe in your, you know, in the department is a man telling you what to do. Who cares if it's a man or a woman telling you what to do? You'll always have someone telling you what to do. You cannot avoid this point. So I don't know what you're gaining, what one would gain, really, by way of trying the career option as an opportunity cost, or using it or choosing it above and beyond a child and having a nurturing relationship, which is the deepest thing. Think about it for a second. Like, let's be emotional for a second, yeah? And this will be the last thing I will say. Many women, if they have young babies, it's not incredulous for us to believe that they would put their own life on the line to protect their children, correct? Something that is so meaningful that would put make you die to protect your own child. That. How can this be compared? I couldn't accept that a woman would die for her company. Especially if she's, sorry to say, but she's working in a lower position. I can't imagine someone working in McDonald's. You have McDonald's here, I don't know. Or Belgian waffle shop. And then a guy comes and says, give me all the waffles. And she says, not when I'm here. She says, not when I'm here. I'm going to die for this one. Yes. Or she's working in McDonald's. She's flipping some pancakes or burgers or something. And this and that. And someone comes and says, no, give me two barbecue sauces. Give me two, three. No, I'm going to take it by force. No, you're not. I'm going to come out and I'm going to fight you for it to the death. The reason why a woman wouldn't do that is genuinely because she does not value, for the most part, women do not value their careers as much as they could ever value children that they have. And that's the bottom line, to be honest with you. And that itself is a proof that you'll be wasting your time if you choose A over B. And I'm not saying, therefore, women shouldn't work and stay at home and, you know, no, there's cases which that should be the case. But what I'm saying is, this prescription that was given from feminists and this domestic drudgery, attack on the family, attack on motherhood, wallahi, we would be fools, especially with what I've just mentioned to you. We would be absolutely fools to engage in a life like that. We're going to go for Maghrib and inshallah we'll come back for the Islamic prescription. Failed advice of the feminists. It's not going to be good. Now, what is the advice? Now, as Muslims, I'll say, first of all, the Quran says, وَلَا تَتَمَنَّوا مَا فَضَّلَ اللَّهُ بِهِ بَعْضُكُمْ عَلَى بَعْضٍ لِلرِّجَالِ نَصِيبٌ مِمَّا اكْتَسَبُوا وَلِلنِّسَاءِ نَصِيبٌ مِمَّا اكْتَسَبْنَ وَاسْأَلُوا اللَّهَ مِنْ فَضْلِهِ. That do not wish what the other one has. Do not wish what the other one has. For a man is a portion of what he has earned, and for a woman is a portion of what she has earned. And ask Allah from his bounty. Meaning what? Meaning, I shouldn't, there are some things women can do, and yes, we don't define, we have a fixed definition of what a woman is. We do. We have a fixed definition of what a male and a female. We can come to that maybe in the questions and answers. Is gender a social construct and these questions? But let's just go with our paradigm for a second. We shouldn't want what the other one has. There are certain things that a man can do better than a woman on average. And there are certain things a woman can do better than a man on average. And it's economically efficient as well as productive for both to know where that is. I'll give you a counter example of this. In New York, they have a fire department. You know, a fire department where they put out the fires and all these kinds of things. Now, they have an obstacle course, because as a fireman, you have to do an obstacle course. When men and women would want to be firefighters, they would go on the obstacle course. Now, we've heard of equality of outcome versus equality of opportunity. So they wanted equality of opportunity to be more, yes? Because actually, men are faster than women. I don't think there's any problem in me saying this. Men are faster than women. Men are stronger than women. Men are more emotionally stable than women. And that's not what I said. That's what Simone de Beauvoir said. Yes, yeah, I know. There's already contestation. I did that on purpose. Oh, upset. You're getting upset. No, that's not my words. It's Simone de Beauvoir's words. Please attack her. She said that in her book. She said that in her book, The Second Sex. And the chapter is biology. She said men are stronger than women. Women get more nervous breakdowns than men. That's what she was saying in her own words, word for word. So I did that on purpose. I put her words as mine to see if there's going to be reaction. And I heard reaction. But it's not my word, not the Quran. This is Simone de Beauvoir herself, the founding mother of feminism, saying this stuff. White feminism, yes. But you know what? Let me tell you something about white. We'll come to, we'll come to feminism and colonial feminism, but you're Western and you're colonial as well. Because at the end of the day, you're from a privileged position. Yes, fine. We'll come to this. We'll come to it. Any questions and answers? I'm going to come to you first. What's your name? Qasira. I'm Tawil. All right, now let's go back to the point. Can we calm down? I'm Tawil, I'm tall, you're Qasira. That's your name. Anyways, we'll come back to you, yeah? The Quran states, الرجال قوامون على النساء بما فضل الله بعضهم على بعض وبما أنفقوا من أموالهم. That men are the maintainers and protectors of women. Men, the Quran states, وللرجال عليهن درجة. That for men, they have a degree of authority. Yes, I know some kuffar in this audience will laugh at this, but for me, the Muslim, I don't laugh at the Quran. I don't laugh at the Quran. I don't. Yeah, if you laugh at Quran, yes. If you laugh at the Quran, you're a kafir. Billah al-Azim. Yeah. Whatever. Please don't. Fine. Oh, fine. What do you think of the ayah? So it's different. It's not applicable. Is it applicable or not? Is it applicable, yes or no? Okay, we're done now. We'll come back. Q&A, you're going to have your chance. Qasira, you'll have your chance. Right? See, Nasira. You'll have your chance. But we have to give each other time to speak. I'll give you time to speak. By the way, I'll let you speak. I didn't call you kuffar. No, I didn't call you. I didn't mention Qasira or Nasira or anybody kuffar. Yeah? I said some. I didn't say you. Yes? We'll come back in the Q&A, Nasira. I know you're triggered. Let's calm down. We'll come back. We can all calm down. We can have fun. We can eat tajine. We can eat this and that, waffle, this and that. Yeah? Anyway, point is this. Quran makes certain distinctions between males and females. Very clear. And these are qat'i. These are things, is ma'lum min ad-din bid-darura. Things that are known in the religion by way of necessity. These are ayat la tahtamilu ta'wil. These are ayat which there is no interpretation except for one interpretation on. Like qul huwallahu ahad. There are some ayat in the Quran which are muhkamat, which are clear cut and decisive. منه آيات محكمات هن أم الكتاب وأخر متشابهات فأما الذين في قلوبهم زيغ فيتبعون ما تشابه منه ابتغاء الفتنة وابتغاء تأويله وما يعلم تأويله إلا الله. إذن This ayah is saying that the Quran has some ayat which are muhkam, which are clear cut and they cannot be interpreted in any other way, and others which are mutashabih, which are ambiguous. For the ones who have some disease in their heart, they will try and interpret those verses which are ambiguous in a way to suit their own agenda. And also that they can create fitna and that they can have their own ta'wil, their own interpretation. And no one knows the true interpretation of those verses except for Allah. And on this point, by the way, since we're now talking about the Islamic position, there were some people who came to the Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam and the Sahaba, and they were making fun of some of the ayat. And they were saying this and that about the Prophet. Allah, he sent down a surah to Tawbah. La ta'taziru qad kafartum ba'da imanikum. Why? And they were saying, inna kunna nahudu wa nal'ab. The Quran says that they said this. We were just playing and messing about. So Allah then states, la ta'taziru. Do not make excuses. قَدْ كَفَرْتُمْ بَعْدَ إِمَانِكُمْ. You have become disbelievers after you were believers. So one of the things which we as Muslims must be very clear, we can all have our opinions, but the muhkam, the decisive positions on gender are known. And they are known for 1,400 years of Islamic history. And they include al-qawama. They include the fact that a man is to be maintaining and responsible for a woman. بِمَا أَنفَقُوا مِنْ أَمْوَالِهِمْ. That is their duty to do so. Even if the woman has a full-time job and they've agreed upon that, and she's working 9 to 5, she doesn't have to spend a penny of her money. The man must maintain through provision. That, number one. Number two, the woman in issues to do with managerial hierarchy must obey the husband. And that's in the Quran. فَإِنْ أَطَعْنَكُمْ فَلَا تَبَغُوا عَلَيْهِنَّ سَبِيلًا. Ta'a is in the Quran. Ta'a, if someone says, I don't believe in obedience to the husband, they are a kafir billah al-azim. Why? Because the Quran says, فَإِنْ أَطَعْنَكُمْ. I'm not even going to hadith. Because the hadith is clearly, وَطَاعَتْهُ وَإِنْ أَطَاعَتْهُ دَخَلَتْ الْجَنَّةِ. If a woman, she does this and this and this, and she is, has ta'a for the husband, she goes to heaven from any bab she wants, any door she wants. What now? Does it mean to say that a man can be an authoritarian, a dictator in the house? No, it doesn't mean that. But it means that there's a managerial hierarchy in the house. And it means that the husband, on certain issues, has a final say. Where's the limitation of that? The limitation of that is as follows. Number one, if he says to do something which Islam doesn't say, لا تعت لمخلوق في معصية الخالق. That's hadith. That you cannot obey the creation in the disobedience to the creator. Which means that if your husband tells you to do something which is haram, you're not allowed to do that. Number two, if he tells her to do something which are her rights. For example, if he says to her, go and work. Then she doesn't have to do, see, wait a minute, that's your job. Go and protect, like that situation I was giving you before. No. If there's a physical situation, the man must actually be part of that. So a man cannot tell a woman to do something which are already part of his rights. Or her rights, I should say. Number three, if it causes her darar, which means if it causes her significant harm, and the harm must be substantive, it must be real. It must be, oh, I'm getting mental health, and it's not actually the case. Is you're just using it as a card. It must be real. And at the end of the day, there are genuine cases and disingenuine cases. I'm talking about the genuine cases. If there are genuine cases, this person is causing you harm. Yes, if this is genuine and that woman knows for a fact, this is genuine, yes, I fear this man, I whatever, that's darab, that's harm. But apart from that, the husband has the final say. And that is not something remarkable to me, considering the fact that a woman is way more influential in other spheres. For example, if she has children, then the influence of a mother on a child is going to outweigh, in most cases, the influence of the father to the child if both parties are present in the same structure. And so what this does is it calibrates the situation. In most governments, you have checks and balances. You have checks and balances. If all of the influence or power belonged to one party, then there would be real problems. And if you don't have a decision maker in a government or an organization, you have chaos. So this system was devised as a result where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because أَلَا يَعْلَمُ مَنْ خَلَقَ وَهُوَ اللَّطِيفُ الْخَبِيرُ. Does he not know what he created? And he is al-latif and al-khabir. Al-latif, the all-subtle. Al-khabir, the all-aware. He knows what he created. He knows. وَلَيْسَ الذَّكَرُ كَالْأُنْثَى. And the man or the male is not the same as the female. All of that, the Quran states that, by the way. All of that is something known. So Allah now, he tells us, these are the roles. These are the gender roles. 1, 2, 3. There are certain things a man can do that a woman cannot do. You know them. A man can marry 4 wives. A woman cannot marry 4 husbands. I don't know why you're smiling, brother. Try and go for one at least, you know, first. And we'll talk about that later, you know. Now it's true. A woman can put it in her contract not to have more, according to the Hanabila. And Ibn Qudamah mentions this in Mughni Ansar, and there's other madahib. But the point is that that's the thing. A man can marry a Christian and a Jew, whereas a woman can only marry a Muslim man. Yes, that's true. A man can give talaq straight away, unless the woman is in menstruation. He can give, just say, you're talaq, and that's that. And a divorce will take place. Yes, she will have to stay in the house for 3 months and all of these things. Yes, but that these are provisions that a man has that a woman does not have in Islam. These are provisions that a man has. They're clear cut in the Quran al-Kareem. And anyone who denies them is a kafir, a disbeliever, because they're not subject to interpretation. And once the ayat have been shown to those people, and I show these are the ayat, they say, no, I still disagree. Say, well, kafir, I have no problem making takfir. Because at the end of the day, Islam, اليوم أكملت لكم دينكم وأتممت عليكم نعمتي ورديت لكم الإسلام دينا. Today I have perfected your religion. Allah says in the Quran, today I have perfected your religion and I've completed my favor upon you. And I've chosen Islam as a religion for you. He didn't say, Allah didn't say, اليوم أكملت لكم دينكم and then you can change it when you want. Doesn't say that. So this is extremely important. There are some things which we are malleable about in Islam. We can compromise with. But as we mentioned yesterday, وَدُّوا لَوْ تُدِهِنُوا فَيُدِهِنُونَ. They wish that they could compromise, that you could compromise with them because they would compromise with you. Today we're living in an age, I'll be honest with you guys, and this will be the last thing that I'll say, before the questions and answers. We are living in an age where there is a new religion. Anthropologists today and historians, they look in the past and they look at the ancient mythological fictitious gods of the past. Zeus, Hercules, these gods, you know, Isis, Orisis, these, not the Isis, but the Isis. I know you think that I'm talking about. No. And we say, look at these people. They were very clever people, but they also believed in these false idols, yes? I have a theory, which maybe in the future, 100 years from now, 200, 300 years, there's going to be some people that will look at Western civilization in the 21st century. And maybe in a university like this, they'll say, look, what's a very unusual kind of mythology they believed in, isn't it? Say, what kind of mythology is that? They believe that a person who is empirically justified from a scientific perspective as being a male can be a female. This is myth. It's mythology. It is mythology. If you say, well, I can identify as a male, the penis, sorry to say, and this and that, I can identify as a female. Then as a black man or a white man, I may identify as a black man. Then by the way, I'll tell you, I was interested. I did gender studies on a postgraduate level. As many of you know, I wrote a book on feminism, yeah? And when I was doing the postgraduate, I was in the lift one time. I was in the lift. And there was one of these ultra left-wing feminists there. She said, out of nowhere, sitting down, she said, you know, the penis is a social construct. That's what she said. I didn't want to be inappropriate and said, yani, how have you discovered this or that? But what I said was, and it was quick, and it was, yani, I said, listen, I'm sorry to say, if you say the penis is a social construct, did you know what else is a social construct? She said, what? I said, rape. That is what happens. And if you say that race is a social construct, and in my book, to be honest with you, I refuted Judith Butler, third wave feminist, yeah? Who said that, because I was reading her books, and I found that she was basically saying that gender is a social construct, and sex is a social construct. She said sex itself is a social construct. Yeah, she did say that in Gender Troubles, yeah? So I said, interestingly, if you say that, then you say race is a social construct. Because it's biological, you can see race from there. But if race is a social construct, what else is a social construct? Racism. So you can decide to have your fiction. But you have to accept that your fiction brings about other fictions that you don't like. It begets fictions that you won't like. The point here I'm saying is this, is that we must understand we're living in an age. Back in this day, in this very country, Leopold II or whoever it was, in the 1885, he went to Congo and he bought it with his private land as a private country, made it his country, colonized it. Unfortunately, we thought the days of colonialism were over. You just go to Congo and buy it and this and that. I was thinking, how could a country as small as Belgium even colonize another country? They did it because Congo was having a hard time at that time. Internal wars, all this. It was just opportunistic by this king. And by the way, this was a liberal guy. This was after the revolution, the Enlightenment, and all these kinds of things. He went and took Congo with his money. Now, the colonialism that we're living is not the same kind of colonialism. Now we're living, we think, oh, these days are over. Now, it's not Leopold II that's going to come with his troops to Congo, but it's going to be the Western feminists, whatever color they may be. Western feminists, whatever color they may be, whether it's Audrey Lorde or bell hooks, whatever, it doesn't matter. Western feminists, they're not from Africa, are they? Not from the village. They are not from the village. They are writing from the West. Those Western feminists now are colonizing our very minds. And I would say, honestly, that wallahi is a more pernicious and more disabling and more micro kind of colonism, which we all need to be aware of. Jazakumullahu khairan, and questions and answers will ensue.